voice breaking. How old are you?
I'm 16 at 2:31 today, Natalie says, her eyes focused on the table lamp.
My father presses his lips so hard together they turn white. The tears are falling again, so fast it looks as if he can't see. He puts his arm around me and pulls me to Natalie. He puts his other arm around her.
I am, he wipes at his eyes with his shoulder so he doesn't have to let go of us. So very proud of my children. So very proud.
A sob escapes his chest.
What wonderful people you've grown to be.
36. Waiting. Tuesday, May 28th, 1935. The next morning, I feel my mother watching me as I rinse my cereal bowl, search for my history homework, put on my socks. She has her makeup on, but her eyes look puffy, her face swollen.
What?
I ask her. She says nothing, busies herself getting Natalie ready to go. When I get home from school, Teresa, Natalie, and my mother are sitting in the living room. My mother is radiant. Natalie was wonderful. She spoke clearly in the new Natalie way. She tried her best to look at Mr. Purdy when she spoke. She even told a joke. A joke! Why did the chicken cross the road? My mom said Natalie asked Mr. Purdy.
Well, I don't know, Natalie, Mr. Purdy had said.
Because one of his buttons rolled to the other side, Natalie said.
Okay, it wasn't funny, but still.
Even as happy as my mother seems about this, she is still watching me in a way that makes me uncomfortable. Come on, Moose, she says after I polish off a stack of cold pancakes from last night's supper. I want to talk. Just the two of us. Teresa chatters on about tomato juice. Natalie seems to be listening. I even see her look up at Teresa once or twice. Teresa has a real instinct for what Natalie will find fascinating.
Who's going to watch Natalie? I ask, though really what I'm wondering is what my mom wants to talk about. I don't have talks with my mom, only with my dad.
Me, of course, Teresa says. My mom nods. She smiles at Teresa, but not at me. It's almost as if she doesn't want to look at me. We walk down the stairs to the dock. She fiddles with the button on her sweater.
I'm sorry about last night, she says.
What do I say to this? Nothing. I say nothing. I'm too angry to make this easy for her.
She looks across the water to Berkeley. I didn't like it. I didn't like what you said. She shakes her head.
She dragged me all the way out here to say that? This has to be the biggest understatement in the world.
You didn't care that it made me mad, my mom says in a quiet tone of voice. You didn't care that it upset your father. You didn't care that it was the night before Natalie's interview. You didn't care about anything. I have never been so furious with anyone in all my born days.
My mom's voice is strangely calm. She isn't angry, but I am. I am seething inside. I open my mouth to tell her how wrong she is, how unfair she's being.
Wait. She holds her finger to her lips. Let me finish. But I see how much you care about Natalie. That's the part that didn't make sense. All night I tossed and turned. I kept asking why. Moose, of all people, why did he say that? Why? And you know what? I could only come up with one answer. You did it because you believed in your heart it was the right thing to do. You were doing what you thought would help your sister.
She stops. Tears spill down her face.
I can't imagine how I could ask for anything more from you. I can't imagine how I could.
She's crying now, but watching me, looking at me. I take a swallow of air like suddenly I have to remind myself to breathe. My mother never does this. She never tries to imagine how I feel. I take another swallow of air and pretend interest in a big barge moving slowly past Angel Island. I don't want to cry.
Did you tell Mr. Purdy? I ask. My words come out deep and rich. I hardly recognize my voice.
No.
My mother looks directly at me now.
He didn't ask, and I didn't say. But it's a conversation we need to have. I know that now, Moose.
Her voice squeaks.
I do.
That night, my mother makes a wonderful dinner. Roast beef and Yorkshire pudding, green beans with almonds, orange salad, cornbread and cream of asparagus soup. She is just cutting into the lemon meringue pie when we hear the knock.
Mrs. Cocconi,
my dad whispers. Natalie stops eating. My mom takes a deep breath. She hands me the pie server. My father takes her hand. Together they follow Mrs. Cocconi. Our apartment is suddenly so silent, so empty. Natalie's head moves down close to her plate, the way she always used to eat. I only realize now it's been months since I've seen her eat this way. She shovels her pie in, one bite after another, with no time to chew. I keep eating, but now the pie tastes dull and cold, like baby food. I cut myself another piece, but I can hardly chew. My neck stiffens. It turns to stone. My stomach feels as if I've swallowed a quart of vinegar.
Where are they?
My father's footsteps on the landing are slow and heavy. When he opens the door, his face is sagging and deeply wrinkled.
The decision is the same. Not ready. He informs the floor.
My dad's shaking hand finds his toothpicks. He pops two in his mouth, goes in his room, and closes the door. 37. Carrie Kelly. Same day, Tuesday, May 28th, and Wednesday, May 29th, 1935. I'm in bed, listening to the sound of my mother crying and the deep, even rumble of my father's voice trying to comfort her. The Esther P. Marinoff is a crummy place, a cruel joke. I never did like that, Mr. Purdy. I try to go to sleep, but I keep thinking about Natalie at home in Santa Monica, living her life in the back room of our house and on the steps of Graham's. I rode bikes with Pete, played ball, did my homework. She did not. I will graduate from high school, go to college, get married, have kids. She will not. My mom's done a million things to help Natalie. The aluminum treatments, the voodoo dolls, UCLA, the psychiatrists, the Bible readings, Mrs. Kelly. What good were they? Nothing has helped. But suddenly I see this isn't true. One thing has helped. Carrie Kelly. Natalie has been more a part of things here on this island than she ever has before. She's had a life here for the first time. Maybe just a little bit of a life, but a life just the same. When I wake up the next morning, I find Mrs. Kelly's number in my mom's phone book. I borrow a nickel from my dad and head down to the phone outside of Mrs. Cocconi's. I put the nickel in the coffee can Mrs. Cocconi keeps by the phone and tell the operator the number. Mrs. Kelly, I say when the operator signs off. This is Moose Flanagan, Natalie's brother. I'm calling to thank you. You've really helped my sister.
Why, dear, I appreciate you saying that.
And I wanted to ask you, do you believe the Esther P. Marinoff will help Natalie? She sighs.
Yes, I do. I worked there for 5 years. I saw kids improve in ways I never saw any place else I've ever been. Natalie wasn't ready in January, but I think she is now. I'd like her to start in June, and I'd like to keep working with her for the first year at least. But unfortunately, Mr. Purdy doesn't agree with me.
Is there anything we can do to change his mind? She sighs.
I wish I knew. As I explained to your mother last night, I expected her to be accepted.
Did her, you know, age?
I squeeze the words around the lump in my throat. Hard to say. I can certainly understand what your mother was up to with that. There's a real bias against older children. And I can't swear I wouldn't have tried the same thing if I were in her shoes. Sometimes with these kids it's difficult to tell exactly how old they are, but in the case of your sister, I'm afraid it's pretty clear she's at least 14.
Yeah, I say in a small voice.
I will keep working on this, Moose. I promise you I will. But I don't want to give you folks false hope.
Yes, ma'am, I say.
And Moose, there's something I wanted to tell you too, dear. When Natalie and I are working together, and I see I'm starting to lose her, I always say, what do you think Moose is doing right now? And lately, she's been able to stay with me. She talks about you at school, or playing catch, or talking with Teresa, and she's able to keep herself with me that way. I thought you might like to know how important you are to her.
Yes, ma'am.
I wipe the tears off my face. I'm sorry I can't do more. You have no idea how sorry I am.
When I hang up the phone, I know I have to do something. Have to. I have no idea what. I wonder if this is how my mother feels, how she has always felt. Now I understand. When you love someone, you have to try things even if they don't make sense to anyone else. After breakfast, I march up the hill to the warden's house. I don't know why I'm going there, except he's the most powerful person I know. If anyone can change this, he can. But the closer I get to the warden's house, the slower my feet go. The warden will be at work in the cell house. If I want to talk to him, I'll have to knock on that door. I stare at the big steel cell house door, unable to move forward or back. My heart beats in my ear, and my hands are ice cold. I stay stuck until a voice calls my name.
Hey, Moose, what are you doing up here? Aren't you supposed to be in school?
I spin around to see Mr. Trixel. He has a cigarette in his mouth and a clipboard in his hand.
Sorry, Moose. Didn't mean to scare you. What's up?
My mind is whirling. What am I doing? What am I doing?
Moose? Officer Trixel asks.
I need to talk to Warden Williams, I say.
Can't it wait till tonight, son?
Officer Trixel takes a drag from his cigarette. Yes, I mean no, I mutter.
Yes, you mean no. Which is it?
He smiles kindly. No, I say. Officer Trixel grunts. He drops his cigarette on the cement and stamps it out with his foot. Then he buzzes the entry bell. The big steel hinges squeak shrill and sharp as the door opens.
Wait here, Officer Trixel says.
And the door slams, a solid steel closed behind him. I wait a long time, wondering if they've forgotten about me. I'm considering giving up when the cell house door squeaks open again and Officer Trixel and the warden appear. The warden is as neat as ever, like he just came out of the barber shop. He smells of soap and cut grass.
Good morning, he says.
Good morning, sir, I say. He looks around as if he doesn't know where to sit. He seems to decide on the bench, gives his trousers a tug, and sits down. Officer Trixel walks back to the cell house door and stands stiff and straight, not smoking now.
So,
he folds his hands in his lap,
What's this all about, Moose?
I stammer, my forehead suddenly sweaty. I know you know important people in San Francisco. I was just wondering if you might call some of your, you know, friends, and maybe they might ask the Esther P. Marinoff to reconsider. Natalie is doing much better. She should have gotten in.
Influence. Is that what you're after, son?
Yes, sir, I say.
I'll give it some thought, but offhand I can't come up with anyone who might be helpful with this.
He sighs and shakes his head. He seems truly sorry. We sit silent for a moment. The warden looks at his watch.
Now, it's time you were in school. Bet you can make the 8:30 if you run like the dickens.
He pats my arm and gets up. Thanks, sir, I say. But, you know, I had an idea. He makes a pained noise in his throat. I was thinking... My voice cracks. The idea is crazy, but I can't stop myself. How about Al?
Excuse me?
The warden asks. I clear my throat and try to say it louder, but it still comes out in a croak. Al Capone! The warden squints his eyes, just like Piper does. He makes an annoyed sound and shakes his head.
Oh, please don't tell me this is another stunt.
No, sir, I'm serious. He's the only one who can do this.
Moose, that's nonsense, and I think you know it.
I think he could. He sighs a long and labored sigh.
First off, that's doubtful. But even if he could, do you really think I'd allow it? I've built this place on fairness, on treating all of the convicts the same. If I were to ask Al Capone to do me a favor, what kind of precedent would that be setting? He was sent here because he got preferential treatment in Atlanta, ran his empire from prison while the government footed the bill, brought his own furniture, oriental rugs, silk underwear, treated him like royalty behind bars. Do you think I want to pave the way for something like that here? It would make a mockery of everything I stand for.
I look directly into his blue eyes. Remember you said we should think hard about going against the rules? Remember you said that. Well, I have thought hard. The warden meets my gaze.
I see that, he says. But in this case you're asking me to bend the rules, and I'm not about to. You may think it's the right thing to do, but I do not.
You don't have to give him anything. Just ask him. What's the harm of asking, sir? The warden takes a deep breath.
Look, Moose, you want to help your sister, and that's admirable. But I can't help you with this. Your parents will work something out. Now, run along.
Run along? Run along? He can't tell me to act like an adult one moment and treat me like a kid the next. This makes me so furious, my mouth shoots off before I can stop it. You didn't mean it, did you, sir? It was just a speech. You don't really want us to think. You want us to obey. I can see the anger flash through the warden's eyes. He takes his foot off the bench and stands straight.
I know you and your family have been through a lot, so I'm going to ignore that comment. But if you speak to me like that again, I will have you and your family off the island in the blink of an eye. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir, I say, my whole body trembling. He continues to stare, then seems to decide I've gotten his point. He sighs and crosses his arms.
Look, son, it isn't that easy. The world isn't going to kiss your boots because you learned to think. You have your answer. It's no. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have things to do.
38. What happened? The weekend of June 1st and 2nd, 1935. My mother calls in sick to her piano students and stays in her room. Now when the door opens, a stuffy, stale smell comes out,
and I see her in her bathrobe, her hair tangled like seaweed. My father is a terrible cook. I look down at my supper plate, fried beets swimming in a pool of bright pink juice, half-cooked hash browns turned pink where they border the beets in cold oatmeal. My father seems to notice my reaction to his cooking.
If she's still in bed tomorrow, I'll bring home convict cooking. I promise, he says.
Thanks, Dad, I say. Natalie is quiet. She has counted the shredded beets on her plate and organized them so they are lying in a line like 20 men in sleeping bags. She seems to be trying to decide what to do with the oatmeal when all of a sudden she blurts out,
"Why did the chicken cross the road?"
"I don't know," I say.
"His buttons rolled to the other side,"
Nat says, picking at her napkin. She looks at me and runs her tongue over her upper lip. Then she wraps her arms around herself as if she needs them to hold her chest together and begins to rock.
"What happened? What happened?" Natalie asks.
"Nothing happened, Natalie. Mommy isn't feeling well, and we're just not sure the Esther P. Marinoff is the right school for you," my father says.
"Mommy is angry," Natalie says. My father and I look at each other. His lip quivers and his voice gets gritty.
"No, she's not mad at you, honey. You did everything right, Natalie."
"Not mad at you, honey,"
Natalie says, digging her chin into her collarbone.
"Not mad at you, honey,"
she repeats, adding extra pauses between the words.
"Oh, God," my father says. "Natalie, sweetheart, you were great. No one is mad at you."
But Natalie doesn't look at him. She looks at the butter, not past it, not through it, but at it, as if it is the most interesting thing in the world.
"You won't believe what I did," I tell Annie and Teresa the next day. I ask the warden if he'd get Al Capone to help us get Natalie into school.
"You didn't," Annie says.
"I did."
"He said no," Teresa says. I nod. "Well, that's a big surprise," Annie says. "You didn't really think he'd say yes, did you?"
I shrug.
"What's Capone going to do anyway? It's not like he gets out on the weekends to run around town breaking people's legs," Annie says.
"He could help if he wanted. This is small potatoes for him," I say. "He can do anything."
Annie shakes her head.
"The guy's in prison. He can't do anything. You've been spending too much time with Piper."
She's right. I know she is. The man's locked up. But this one sentence keeps floating around in my head. "He could if he wanted to. He could if he wanted to."
It's when I see Piper that I realize what I'm going to do. "I'm going to write a letter to Al Capone," I tell her. She rolls her eyes.
"They don't let just anyone write to Capone, you know. You have to be a relative, and then it's censored."
"Yeah, but it's your mom who censors his mail, right? Couldn't I just drop a letter in the stack of already censored mail?"
"I've tried that," Piper says, running her fingers through her long hair.
"You did? What happened?"
"Nothing. Never answered back. I told him to check out Jane Eyre from the convict library and put his answer in it."
"Jane Eyre? Maybe that was the problem. Can you imagine Al Capone reading Jane Eyre?" I ask.
"That's the point, Einstein. A book like that would never be checked out. What con would read Jane Eyre? And besides, then my dad wouldn't give me grief for wanting to read it because I had to get him to check it out from the con library for me. I figured Capone could write back in the book. You know, underlining very faintly in pencil the way the cons do."
"No, I don't know."
"Let's say you want to say, 'I need your help.' You go carefully through the book and look for an I and underline it, and then an N and underline it, and an E, and so on until you've spelled your whole message. Did he get it? Piper shrugs. Who knows? I never got an answer back.
What was the message?
I asked him if he'd autograph a baseball and hit it over the wall. I told him I'd auction it off, said we'd split 50-50.
Don't you think he has enough money?
I ask. No one ever has enough money, Piper says.
But you didn't get in trouble for this, right? So what's the harm?
I ask. Easy for you to say. The only thing your parents did was take away your baseball glove. Not exactly a hardship.
You're one to talk. You didn't get punished at all.
Yes, I did. You think I wanted 2 months with my grandma? She's always crabby, and everything she eats is boiled. Boiled cabbage, boiled turnips. She even boils hamburger.
I thought you said it was fun. She rolls her eyes again.
Ever heard of saving face?
That's what Annie thought, I say.
Yeah, well, you should listen to her. She's right most of the time,
Piper says. Even if you did get in trouble, it doesn't seem to have made any difference to you.
Oh, yeah? Have I gotten in trouble since then? Piper asks.
No, I admit. Still, wouldn't you like to be Big Al's pen pal? This could be the start. She snorts like she doesn't care, but her eyes are so bright, I know this isn't true.
What's he going to do to get Natalie in? She asks.
Beats me, I say.
But if the guy can fix a whole election, he'll figure out something.
In Piper's room the next day, she brings out the special duplicate carbon letter paper her mom uses.
Can you type?
She asks. Nope.
Me neither. Just, you know, hunt and peck. You don't need to worry if you make mistakes. My mom makes them too. And every once in a while, type three dots. That's what she does when she leaves something out. Then, if she happens to glance at your page, she'll think it's a letter she's already finished.
I roll the brown page into her typewriter, click the carriage over, and begin hunting down letters with one finger. Dear Mr. Capone, I live on Alcatraz. I am Officer Flanagan's son. My sister Natalie Flanagan is a little unusual, dot, dot, dot. Ask Onion 105 about her. He'll tell you how nice she is. She needs to be in a school to help her, but they won't let her in. It's the Esther P. Marinoff School in San Francisco, dot, dot, dot. Could you help? The guy who runs it is named Mr. Purdy. I would be so grateful if you could help me with this. Thank you, sir. Sincerely, Moose Flanagan. P.S. I like your mother very much.
I like your mother very much? Piper says when she reads it.
You got to say something about the guy's mother.
Why?
She asks. Because then he remembers he has one, and he knows we know her too. Makes him act better. It's the mom rule. All guys use it.
This is Al Capone we're talking about. I don't think he'll fall for a cheap trick like that.
I'm not taking it out, I say.
Suit yourself.
She takes the letter and presses it in thirds with her thumbnail, making two perfect crisp folds. She disappears with a letter. In less than a minute, she's back.
Piece of cake, she says.
I get up to leave.
Hey, Moose, if this doesn't work, you going back?
Back where?
Santa Monica, stupid. Not that I care anything, because I don't, she says.
Well, if you don't care, why are you asking?
I'm not asking, Piper says.
Oh, now you're not asking. Okay, then, I'm not answering. Piper bites at her bottom lip.
Well, are you?
I don't know, Piper. I walk down the stairs. When I get outside, I see Piper watching me through the window of her dad's library. When she sees I see her, she closes the curtain quick and disappears. 39. The Warden. Tuesday, June 11th, 1935. This last week, things have been better at my house. Natalie is back at Mrs. Kelly's. My mother is teaching piano lessons again, and she and my father are beginning to discuss what they will do next. And every day I wonder if we'll be going back to Santa Monica. It seems so long ago that we lived there now, I'm not even sure I want to anymore. And I know moving back will be bad for Natalie. When I say goodbye to Scout and them on the last day of school, I get a stomach ache. I don't know if it's goodbye for the summer or goodbye for the rest of my life. I feel so lousy, I don't say three words to anyone on the boat ride home. I hardly notice anything until I get off the boat. And then, all of a sudden, there are my parents, Natalie, Teresa, and Warden Williams. My parents never wait for me like this, and it's really strange to see the warden here. He's hardly ever down at the dock. The boat waits for the warden doesn't wait for the boat. Actually, the boat isn't supposed to wait for him either, but it always does. "What's your dad doing here?" I ask Piper. "Beats me," Piper says, like this is no big deal, but she's chewing her gum at twice the usual speed. "Guess what?" My mother jumps up the second we're close enough to hear. "No, wait!" Teresa elbows in front of her. "Let Natalie tell." Natalie frowns down at her feet. "Go on, Nat, tell him," Teresa says. 11 goals, Natalie says. "No, Nat," Teresa shakes her head. 11 goals, Nat says, louder this time. "No, I mean, yeah, you're right, 11 goals, Teresa says. "But what else?" Natalie's shoulders are hunched up like she is stuck in a shrug. She says nothing. "She got into the Esther P. Marinoff," Teresa announces with a big grin. "Natalie!" I wrap my arms around her in a spontaneous bear hug. "I don't like that! I don't like that!" Nat says, and I let go. "Sorry, Nat," I say. "Sorry," she says, moving her shoulders now like she's trying really hard to get them to fit. "Sorry, sorry, sorry," she mutters. "Mr. Purdy called," my dad explains. "He's decided to open another branch of the Esther P. Marinoff for older children, and he wants Natalie to be the first student." "You sure? I mean, this is for sure?" I ask. My dad nods. "Apparently he's been planning this for some time, been waiting for the right moment to launch it." "How come he didn't tell us that before?" I say. My father looks sideways at my mother. My mother shakes her head. "We don't know," she says. The warden clears his throat. I can feel the heat of his eyes on me. I glance at him and then away. A patch of sweat breaks out on my forehead.
"See, Moose," the warden says. "Didn't I tell you your parents would work it out?"
He winks at me and smiles out of one side of his mouth. Then he turns his attention to Piper.
"Sweetheart, just wanted to tell you how proud I am of your grades. Straight A's, again."
He waves her report card in the air like he wants us all to see.
"Thank you, Daddy,"
Piper says as the warden puts his arm around her. I watch them walk up the hill. When they are out of earshot, I ask my dad, "Just all of a sudden like that?" My dad nods. He chews at his bottom lip.
"You know anything about this, Moose?" he asks.
"No," I answer, almost before he gets the question out. He nods like he believes me, then pops a toothpick in his mouth.
"Life is amazing, isn't it? You can't ever tell what will happen. Nobody knows until they go ahead and play the game."
"You can say that again," I say. 40. Al Capone does my shirts. Wednesday, June 12th, 1935. The next morning, I get up and pull a clean shirt off the hanger. As I shoot my arm through the sleeve, I hear something crackle. I dig my fingers in the pocket and pull out a torn scrap of brown paper. It's folded in half and in half again. Inside is one word, scribbled hastily in pencil and underlined twice. "Done," it says. Author's note: Alcatraz Island, When Truth is Stranger Than Fiction. Al Capone Does My Shirts is a work of fiction, but many of the details about life on Alcatraz are true. During the 29 years when Alcatraz was a working penitentiary, 1934 to 1963, or, as one convict described it, a maximum security, long-term burying ground for convicts of particularly vile renown, the families of most of the guards and prison administrators lived on the island. Between 50 and 60 families resided on Alcatraz at any given time. 9 babies were born to mothers who lived on the island, and some children lived their entire childhood on Alcatraz. There was a whole village on the island, a post office with a pelican insignia postmark, a tiny grocery store, a play area called the Parade Grounds, and an officers' club, complete with a bowling alley. Many of the kids lived in 64 Building, an Army-issue apartment building that still stands today. No children were ever hurt or taken hostage during the Alcatraz penitentiary years. One guard felt that there was an unwritten code of rule among the inmates that family men were safe. This may have been true for some convicts, but certainly not all. During the Battle of Alcatraz in May of 1946, 2 guards were killed and 14 injured. Almost all were family men. At least one autobiography of an Alcatraz inmate contains detailed escape plans, which included taking the warden's wife as a hostage. Today it seems surprising that so many children lived on Alcatraz, but at the time, Alcatraz was thought to be a better place for kids than the city. Quote, "Our parents frequently said they felt safer living on Alcatraz than in San Francisco. There was no traffic, no burglaries. Few of us, in fact, worried about security. It was a low-crime neighborhood after all. Fences and locked gates were everywhere, yet some residents didn't lock their doors." End quote. "All of our bad guys are locked up," is a refrain sounded again and again in the handwritten accounts of island life found in the Alcatraz Island Ranger Library. Also, it was much cheaper to live on Alcatraz. 1935 was a depression year, and San Francisco rents, even then, were costly. Prison guards were not highly paid, and as one former Alcatraz guard stated, he never even considered living off the island as it was too expensive to live in San Francisco. But perhaps the most important reason families lived on the island in the early years was because Warden James A. Johnston wanted it this way. Ready access to his staff of guards in the event of a prison break was an important aspect of his overall security plan. High-ranking officers were expected, perhaps even required, to live on Alcatraz. "When we had a disturbance, if we were at a party, we didn't put on our coats or anything. We just went right up the hill. They used to call down at 64 Building, and the phone was right outside my apartment, and we answered the phone, and they'd say, 'We have trouble in the cell house,' and that's all they had to say. Everybody available went." The warden lived in a beautiful mansion located right next door to the cell house. Warden Johnston, dubbed Old Saltwater by the cons, opened Alcatraz and ran it for 14 years. Warden Johnston's youngest daughter, Barbara, also lived on the island, though she bears no resemblance whatsoever to Piper. During 1935, all of the Alcatraz kids took the boat to San Francisco, where they attended school. The only exception was made for kindergarten-aged children, who attended a kindergarten held on Alcatraz, taught by one of the moms who lived on the island. As you might imagine, saying you lived on Alcatraz did, in fact, garner quite a lot of attention at school. Some kids thought it was weird. Others were dazzled by the prison stories. Most kids who lived on Alcatraz seemed to take the prison for granted. Jolene Babiak, who was a kid on the island during the 50s, said it was like living next to the police station. She said she wasn't scared because there were so many guards around. Al Capone, AZ-85, was an inmate on Alcatraz for 4.5 years, from 1934 to 1939. Warden Johnston described the intense interest in Capone this way. "The newspaper reporters telephoned me almost every day. How is Capone? Is he still there? Is he going to be transferred? Where is he working?" Very little information came out of Alcatraz, and erroneous reporting was rampant. "At times," Warden Johnston said, "I became fed up with the gossip about him that had no foundation in fact. A story was featured that though Al Capone was in Alcatraz, he was sending orders to a London haberdasher for silk underwear. I assured the director of the Bureau of Prisons that there was no truth in such a report. That I had seen Capone wearing the regulation underwear, and I had noticed it particularly because he had the waist of his drawers fastened with a safety pin." The residents of the island were as interested in Capone as the rest of the world. One boy described watching Capone's first footsteps on Alcatraz. "Our apartment overlooked the island's docks, and my mother's old Kodak box camera took a photo of the first convict's arrival. We lived along the building's upper gallery, but we went down a level to be closer to the action that we had waited months to see. Our binoculars located Al Capone. His face was familiar in those days. No others stood out." Another woman said, "The first prisoners arrived, among them Al Capone." She laughed. "And women and children were requested to stay indoors until the prisoners were locked in their cells. Well, we kind of snuck a look before the boat docked." Capone's first job on Alcatraz was working the mangle in the laundry facility. Thought to be an undesirable post, often offered as a first job because it was boring, back-breaking work. The facility handled the laundry for everyone who lived on the island and for some of the local army bases, like the one on Angel Island. The laundry scheme is fiction. No record of kids selling the opportunity to have a shirt laundered by Capone has ever been found. However, there is documentation of at least one army officer, a private stationed on Angel Island, writing home that his laundryman was Al Capone. "In fact, after completing Al Capone Does My Shirts, I discovered that World War II GIs sometimes used the phrase Al Capone Does My Shorts to indicate they were stationed in San Francisco. Capone was no longer on Alcatraz then, but the Capone mythology was as powerful as ever. In 1935, the convicts played handball and softball in the walled-off recreation yard on the island, and Capone was thought to have played first base. Capone liked baseball. As a kid, he pitched sandlot baseball well enough to cherish dreams of turning pro. The convicts were quite serious about their games and kept careful records of their leagues. They played as avidly as any big league team out to win the pennant. But the rules differed from those of a regular game in one important way. On Alcatraz, if you knocked the ball over the wall, you're out. It was not a home run, and you couldn't get out and get it either. We usually had an inmate that worked outside the wall, the gardener. He would throw them back. The kids who lived on the island did, in fact, collect convict handballs and baseballs. "Once when I was 8, a prisoner found a hard rubber ball in the weeds and beckoned to me. I shyly approached as the guard stood there, and the man pushed the ball through the fence to me. It was a proud moment. I had in my hand the most valuable item on Alcatraz, the coveted black handball that had rolled down the hill from over the prison yard wall." Many of the other details of Capone's time on Alcatraz are also true. There was, for example, a snitch box, which visitors and residents alike were required to walk through when entering the island. And when Capone's mother, Teresina Capone, came to visit him on the island, her corset did indeed set the snitch box off. Mrs. Capone, who barely spoke English, was visibly embarrassed at having to strip down to her corset, revealing the metal stays that had tripped the metal detector. Capone was horribly ruthless, authorizing, and sometimes performing, the slaying of hundreds of people. But he could also be surprisingly generous. When the crash came in 1929, he, Al Capone, was first to open soup kitchens. Some people considered him a Robin Hood kind of character, or, as one fellow Alcatraz convict described him, outside of losing his head so easily and bragging about what he has done, Capone has a heart as big as a house. The accounts of children who grew up on Alcatraz differ according to the time they lived on the island and their own individual experiences. A doctor who worked on the island in 1937 said, "During their play, the children often came into close contact with the prisoners working on the outdoor details." On the other hand, one former Alcatraz Island resident, whom I heard speak, clearly stated she had no interaction with convicts whatsoever during her stay on the island. And a third said she formed a friendship with one convict based on the exchange of flowers. She called this inmate her boyfriend. The convicts' mail was routinely censored, and wives of the guards were occasionally asked to help out with this task. As one convict described it, "It took a letter from 10 days to 2 weeks to get to you after it reached the institution. You see, all the incoming letters are censored and then given to different guards to type in duplicate when they have time. Nothing was personal. Every officer could take your letters and read them and then discuss your personal affairs with each other. The prisoner's personal mail was taken home by different officers to let their wives read." Incredible though it seems, residents of the island sang Christmas carols outside of the cell house with the express purpose of entertaining the convicts. As one woman who lived on the island during the early 40s told me, caroling was a very big thing, and only the children who were the best singers were given the privilege of caroling to the cons. And it is certainly true that convicts were sometimes seen in the residential areas of the island. They were on the dock handling the laundry. They acted as garbage men, gardeners, and sometimes movers and house painters for the guards who lived on the island. And while it is true that convicts were always supposed to be escorted by guards, it is certainly conceivable that in some cases that rule would have been bent or broken. Meeting Capone was a big thrill to kids who lived on the island. One 10-year-old boy described the day he met Capone. "On rare occasions, dependents entered the prison proper. I became a more familiar figure because Dr. Hess, or medical assistant Charles Ping, gave me adrenaline shots for asthma. Of course, my father escorted me to and from the prison hospital dispensary. On the notable occasion, Capone was being treated, and my father's sense of history came through. He said, 'Al, this is my boy Roy. Rollo, Dad's nickname for me, this is Al Capone.' Capone shook my hand, and I said something, and, I suppose, twitched around the way 10-year-olds do. Capone said, 'Good-looking boy, boss.' That was a big moment for a boy, and I can still recall the warmth of Capone's hand around mine." Though every attempt was made to make Al Capone Does My Shirts historically accurate, some details were changed to suit the story. For example, the weather, while true to the San Francisco Bay Area in general, does not reflect the exact weather of 1935. Also, the island was run in rigid military style, with orders working their way down the chain of command. Talking to a kid about the rules of the island would probably be something the warden would have delegated. And though the concept of separate schools for children with problems was certainly in existence, everything else about the Esther P. Marinoff School is completely fictional. About Natalie. The character Natalie Flanagan would probably be diagnosed with autism. Autism is a disease that affects the way your brain and sensory system work. It usually becomes evident in the first 3 years of a child's life. While there is a whole range of behaviors of people with autism, typically a child with autism has an extremely difficult time making eye contact, playing with other kids, and sometimes even speaking. Children with autism are often prone to tantrums, repetitive behaviors, and intense physical sensitivities and desensitivities. Some sensations being heightened and even intolerable, others, which may include pain perception, being diminished or apparently absent. Temple Grandin, perhaps the most famous person with autism in the world today, says autism is a near-normal brain trapped inside a sensory system that does not work. Noted autism experts Theodore and Judith Mitrani describe autism as extreme aloneness from the beginnings of life. Autism wasn't identified until 1943, a full 8 years after this book takes place. Children with what we now call autism received many different diagnoses during the 1930s and were sometimes institutionalized. Up until quite recently, there was little hope for children with autism. As Oliver Sacks put it, we almost always speak of autistic children, never of autistic adults, as if such children never grew up or were somehow mysteriously spirited off the planet. But in the last few years, a lot of progress has been made in the treatment of autism. The most encouraging statistics show that intense early intervention with applied behavioral analysis can help as many as half the children diagnosed with autism to achieve normal functioning. Natalie is a wholly fictional character. She is not meant to symbolize or represent autism in any way. She was inspired by my own sister, Gina Johnson, who had a severe form of autism. This is Kirby Hayborn. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Al Capone Does My Shirts by Jennifer Choldenko. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and directed by Jill Whitesides. Text copyright 2004 by Jennifer Choldenko. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.